Hello, 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 and welcome. Welcome to the Third Opinion. Can you hear us? Can you hear me? Everyone, can you hear me?
Yes.
Okay, hey.
The headphones are very loud.
Very loud.
Yeah.
Turn down your ears. Today on the Third Opinion Uncensored, which is a podcast exploring issues such as public health, media, science, health, well-being, education, censorship. We look beyond the simplified media headlines to create a space for critical thinking, intelligent debate, and the freedom to dialogue. This week, we are very honoured to have, directly from Israel, Natalie Krasnostein. She has a Bachelor of Science in Psychology from Curtin University in Perth, a Diploma of Education from Victoria University in Melbourne, and is a graduate of the John Bolton Theatre School. She is currently doing her Master's in Jewish Studies at Haifa University and is a highly trained, highly talented, I want to add, because I have watched Natalie work and her performances and her mind work over many years now. She's a creator who has worked in the field for 30 years of modern midrash, bibliodrama, theatre, education. She's a writer, an artist, a performer, a psychodramist, workshop facilitator, and much more. She's worked on theatre projects with Aboriginal and Jewish communities in Australia and has run workshops in countries around the world. At the moment, she is teaching at a school in Hadera.
Near Hadera,
in Israel, and it's not your ordinary school. It is a school that has, well, why don't you tell us? Natalie, welcome.
Thank you.
Speak into the microphone.
Okay, thanks for that introduction. I work at a school in Israel called Givat Chaviva International School, and it is a school which works towards building a shared society between Jews, Palestinians, and internationals from all around the world. The curriculum is an IB curriculum. So the
just to explain for people what IB is.
It's the International Baccalaureate, so it's a very high-level critical thinking curriculum that sort of fast-tracks students into the university mindset. The curriculum already teaches theory and other centeredness and international mindedness, etc. So it's a high-level curriculum, not the standard curriculum in Israel. And basically these students come together and they live and learn together for 2 to 3 years. And it's such a unique, incredible social atom because we are essentially at the forefront of what I believe Israeli society should look like. Jews, Palestinians, living together, learning together, facing one another, listening to one another's narratives, and creating a new future, especially given the climate today.
Wow. So it's very relevant to hear your thoughts about this because obviously we're interested in how do we create a peaceful, loving, multicultural society. And now here in Australia, we're also faced with this new threat of growing anti-Semitism, especially amongst young people. So what's your role at the school and why did you choose to work there?
I am a theatre and English teacher, and I'm also the artistic director of school productions. So we run a production every year. I do want to tell you all about last year's production, which was pretty fabulous. We used Grease, the musical, as an entry point and created a musical called Peace, where, I mean, we kept essentially the fun, fabulous songs, but we took really important issues and we put them on stage, and it was just a fabulous celebration of the issues, actually. Like Danny was played by a Palestinian, Sandy was Jew, and we also had all representations of youth. Like we had a toxic masculine figure, we had feminism, we just really put everything on stage, and it was very celebrated. So basically, yep, I teach theatre, I It's a unique school in that the classes are quite small and we get to really get to know. It's a very loving environment. I've never been in a society that loving. And I forgot your question, but because, I mean, we're in our fifth year. I'm in my fifth year. The school is in its sixth year. And because it's new and because we're finding out as we go along really what it is to be able to establish these close relationships, and it's unique in Israel. You know, the societies are quite divided. And this school is just creating a new ethos and a new sense of belonging and community. I have so much to say. I even forgot your question. That's how much I have to say.
I'll give a simple one. Who funds and provides the means for the school to operate?
Okay, so some of it is funded by Misrad HaChinuch, the government funding body in Israel that funds education. Only a little bit, and then the rest is private funding. I mean, one of the buildings was funded by the Austrian government. So we have fierce fundraisers that go around the world, you know, promoting the ideals and getting funding, essentially.
Who started the school? Why was it started?
I guess there was a need. Givat Chaviva, my school sits on the grounds of a wider body. Essentially, Givat Chaviva is renowned to be the land that sits in between Arab and Jewish communities, and it's renowned for this ideal. So there are about 10 organisations on the premises, which include an Arab school, an art gallery, Holocaust Centre, and now lots of people fleeing the war are living there. I think one of the youth movements that had this philosophy in mind started many years ago.
Where's it located?
In Givat Chaviva, which is
near Hadera.
Near Hadera, near Afula, near Pardes Chana. Look it up.
Okay. Thank you. All right. So there's a lot of people invested in this and invested in the ideal around it. Why did you choose to work at that school?
It's funny. When I was in Australia before I moved to Israel, I was asked, why are you moving to Israel? And I said, for love and because I want to make a difference on the ground. And both those intentions came true.
Yay.
See? It works. I found love and then I found a job that has tremendous amount of meaning. I can't leave. It's like, I have an incredible sense of belonging, incredible sense of mission, meaning. I feel like I'm making a difference. It's a small social atom, as I said, but it's exactly what needs to happen. You know, human beings facing one another on a day-to-day basis, being involved in domestic life, like working towards a common mission. This is the only way we're going to break down these echo chambers and these conditionings that we have to be able to live and face the other in just a very normal, natural way. That's the only way.
So tell me a bit more about that, because I'm hearing that your school has the intent to counter the divide caused by the many different narratives.
Correct.
What's different in your school? Apart from the people there, what's different to a normal school? The diversity of the students?
I would say what would make up how and why it's unique. The fact that it is working towards a common mission. Like,
what's the common mission?
15 to 18-year-olds being educated with an excellent education. That's the common mission.
So the International Baccalaureate is the reason that they're there, and that's the education mission?
Mm-hmm. Good education. And then the rest is almost secondary, really, and that's the beauty. I think that's what makes it so effective, is that it isn't people facing the issues and facing the fire and trying to work it out. it's when you face another human being, you can't help but open your heart, and you can't help but sort of melt away all these other-centered angers that we have towards each other. I don't know. I think everyone might be able to relate, but, you know, in families when you're upset with someone and then you see them and then the humanity wins, the humanity takes over at the end of the day, because I think as humans it's easy for us to be angry at the other. We haven't, unfortunately, learned those technologies, how to diffuse, you know, angers so well. But this is it. When you show up every day and face another human being in the staff room and you just got to get a job done, you just forget the issues and you just move towards living, domestic living. It's actually quite simple, really.
Have you attended since October 7?
Yes, our school had about a week on Zoom, and then we went back to school, and it was very, very difficult. It's been very, very difficult, but I think that's another thing that is so beautiful about living in Israel right now, and is just the amount of humanity showing up for one another is unbelievable.
So you're seeing, you're feeling people who are vulnerable having to confront difficult things, but getting through it. Is that what you're meaning? The beauty of it. I want to understand, what does that mean? Because from afar, everyone would think, oh my goodness, that would be so hard to be there now, and you're presenting a completely different understanding.
I think that probably the reason why I might not be as articulate right now is that I think I'm actually still quite traumatized, and I'm finding my way through the trauma. I think everyone in Israel is traumatized, and probably the Jewish people as well. And I think that's a factor that is affecting us all. But what I'm seeing is this resilience that I think is built over thousands of years of having this kind of trauma built in our DNA, and that we just go into coping and we go into action, resilience, showing up. The area that I'm showing up, my sort of war effort, is showing up at school and just loving every human being in front of me, Jewish, Palestinian, international, whatever that is. It's like my love factor has just switched on. And it's so special because, you know, I feel even more ready and available to listen to the many narratives that I haven't been able to listen to in the past. It's like I feel like a soldier on the front of the education system. You know, I'm not a soldier in the army, but I'm a soldier in education, because never before has education been this important. And I really hope to continue to rise to that and keep going. I mean, I will. I feel very mission orientated right now.
Have there been any reported conflicts between the students?
Of course. I mean, I don't live in a utopian society at all. And what I think is so special about this environment is that issues are talked about and faced and worked through. And this is another danger of these echo chamber lifestyles that we all live in. I mean, in so many domains, this keeps repeating itself. We have a narrative and we stick to it and we build on it and we grow it, and then, you know, how often do we really make room for the other? But in this, you know, in my little social atom, my workplace, I'm constantly called to make room for the other, and it's excruciating sometimes, and it's beautiful, and I can't see another way out of this multidimensional, global, where truth itself is in exile. I can't see any other way but to continue this excruciating journey into facing the other and listening and yeah.
When truth is in exile, wow.
Yeah, that's the name of my book.
Wow.
Well, let's plug the book. We've got a title. What else is there?
With a title like that, I think it can be blank inside. It's such a good title. Tell us about that.
You said the word global and things sort of start changing.
I mean, there's so many areas where I think we need to look at this politically. I mean, really, do you want me to really go into it? I have to actually think. But
sorry.
As an educator and, you know, like, we're not really allowed to teach head on the issues right now at our school because it's too sensitive. So we're all sort of called into not bringing anything up to do with the war. I mean, at my school we have some people who have their relatives and children fighting in Gaza, while some people have their relatives and family living in Gaza. So you can't imagine the sensitivities. But we sort of show up for just love and connection, human connection. So, you know, like in my English class and I'm sort of asking what text do I choose in order to teach how you can embrace another narrative and not just stick to our own, because of course it's messy at my school. It's not a utopia, and it's not that we're all trained how to be perfect conflict resolvers and we're all walking around in this state of, you know,
transcendence.
Yeah. Thank you. Not at all. It's so messy and it's so fraught, but how can it not be? And this is what I was saying about I'm choosing text that sort of hit those marks, but do it in a way that, like, I like teaching about Indigenous Australia because it's got nothing to do with them.
Unless you discuss who is Indigenous in Israel.
Well, exactly. And then eventually, well, both. That's the beauty. And wouldn't it be wonderful if we could eventually come to the point where we can actually just... we are so triggered by each other's narratives. It's so... I can't think of another example in the world of people that are so lightning bolt triggered by hearing the other. I can't think... But I know I am, because of my Holocaust DNA, my post-Holocaust DNA. But it's really important that I go on that journey of listening to Palestinians' narrative. I have to.
What happens when you... There's something about hearing and seeing and responding to another person who has a different narrative, but knowing that you're not going to have to just walk away from them, but that you have to remain... in relationship with them. How does that change things?
I mean, it's such a good question, Eva. I mean, I think you've just touched head on the whole issue, because how do we not respond with a trauma response? How do we learn how to sit, hold space, allow another, ground ourselves without feeling like we're going to get killed by hearing another story?
And do we recognise that the accident of birth might be why you're on one side or the other? Can we look at that lens? And I think, you know, it's because in a way we're being asked to look at people through a constructivist lens. How do we have our own narratives? Are our narratives the truth, or are they just something that's constructed in our lives? And can we step away from this idea of right versus wrong versus compassion and acceptance? What do you do in a school where you need to have this underpinning of appreciate these things? How do students, young people, come to that, given that they're surrounded by emotions and trauma and grief?
Exactly. I mean, it doesn't help that the issue itself isn't resolvable. So it's like we can't really teach something that isn't available yet on the world scale to be resolved. Like, when truth is in exile, it's not easy to map it. But I feel that that's why I went back to university. One of my other one of my other war response was to get educated. I'm doing an Arab Israeli history unit. I'm doing history unit on, I mean, I'm doing an anti-Semitism unit, and I just want to get educated. And I think that's what is very important, is to understand the history and not just come from these emotive responses that are reactive and defensive and attacking, because we've seen enough of that, haven't we?
I've heard the truth is in exile a few times today, and I'm wondering what your opinion is on the educational material that's provided to young Palestinian children through UNRWA, which is a body that we all donate to. And from the reports I've read, books have been recovered. You know, everyone's seen it. It's public information. They're teaching to hate and kill, like little kids. And, you know, I've heard personalities are formed by the time you're 5 or 6. So we now have another 30 to 50 years of kids who have been taught to kill and hate Jews.
Yep.
Where do you go with that?
What's the question?
What's your opinion of using education as what I see as a weapon?
Yep, I agree with you. It's disgusting.
When truth is in exile.
Yeah. It's heartbreaking.
Is there an understanding of that? Is there an understanding? Is that within the school, for example, what Michael's just said, would that be seen as something that you wouldn't say?
Exactly.
Yeah.
We wouldn't say that.
Yeah.
We usually don't say a lot about the issue.
Yeah.
That's But then you're safe. Putting the truth in exile.
And because it's part of my terror, it's part of my fear, is to face the issues and teach them. I can't and I don't.
But that's not your role.
It's not my role, and, you know, it's a good question.
I kind of wonder whether any of your students would have had that stuff, you know, 10 years ago. Anyway.
It's a good question. I mean, look, if they're at my school, they don't. They're not really the extremists.
Yeah,
we don't have extremists. We have... Yeah, we don't really have representatives of that voice.
How are the
students selected?
At least
that I don't know, you know. I mean...
Well, people self-select, don't they? If they're going to a international school where there is, you know, Jewish kids and Palestinian kids and kids from other countries, you're going to have people who are accepting of and more interested in a collaborative peaceful dialogue. Why would that be a fair assumption?
Or is there an academic standard?
I do have a response to that, because I'm just thinking about questioning that. But I'm going to try to articulate this. But when you're working towards a shared society, this is what I think as well. You want to build on what is true and rational into the future, rather than kind of. I think people know that. I assume people know that, but. Like, for example, my goal in constructing my curriculum is to, you know, train and to teach this concept of another narrative, and students don't necessarily have that. So if I've spent a year or two or three with these students, and at the end of my program they have been exposed to many narratives, then there's a good chance that they are going to question that. And that's my hope. But also working towards a shared society, I think it's... You sort of don't go into that because you want... Oh, ouch. Because, you know, we want to build what is possible and not what is impossible.
So... You're trying to teach non-attachment at some level to one, because I mean, you know, like I just think about
no,
okay.
I think that's also something I'm mindful is to be able to honour people's cultures. I often use myself as an example about my love of Judaism and my love of the Torah and my worldview based on my Jewishness, which is built on, you know, Torah and understanding of my own family heritage post-Holocaust and all the things that makes me a thinker based on my Jewishness, which is huge and tremendous and so much part of who I am. And I sometimes do reflect that in a way that I'm encouraging students to be able to critically look at their own selves and their own religious, cultural, class background, you know, all of that, because you've got a very confusing system now in which a 15 to 18 year old grows up. Like they've got to process a lot. So did that answer the question?
Well, I'm hearing that there's a respect for one's own culture and there's a appreciation of one's background and one's able to look at that in accepting your narrative and you accepting their narrative. There's this idea of working together, that we're all looking at the world from a different perspective.
Well, that's the hope. I mean, it's an experiment, isn't it? I'm in an experiment. I have no idea. I mean,
called
in
life.
A society that is so fragmented, so divided in so many ways that, you know, I can literally maybe see 2 centimetres in front of me at any given time. And, you know, and I'm an immigrant, a non-speaking language. You know, I don't speak Hebrew fluently. I'm not so deeply engaged in Israeli culture, but I've established my own sense of belonging and my own network and my own place there. I very much belong there and I live there. I feel like I live there. But I'm also an immigrant and I'm also negotiating such a huge set of issues in this world by living there and by working in my school. But it is, of course, it is an experiment, and I don't think there's a perfect system out there. We're trying to, in the collapse of all the systems that are happening right now, we're trying to rebuild, and that's what I'm trying to do, is collapse the systems that don't work and rebuild the systems that do work in my relationships and in how I teach.
Is there a favourite song that you have that we could play to give you a few minutes to breathe as we come back to asking you questions about what can we do here in Australia in terms of education, given what's starting to happen in our country? Do you have a song, a peace song, a war song? I can look it up right here. I found one here called the Jewish Arab Peace Song with English subtitles. Do you know this?
I don't, but put that one on, and I'm going to choose the second song.
Okay, I hope it's good. Let me just try.
How many students altogether are in the place?
About 150.
150.
In year 10, 11, and 12.
And are there any sporting teams?
I think they do have, like, basketball and soccer, but, I mean, I'm a theatre person, so.
And what's
I
the,
don't know.
And roughly what's the gender split?
I think it might be slightly more females. 51% or something.
Right.
I vaguely remember.
Okay,
we're going to try this, okay? 1 second.
I saw a great nigun on Facebook today where you had a bunch of Hasidim around a table and they were doing a nigun that was a and it was a Christmas carol. It was very good.
אנחנו כן נבסולה בשביל שחולה Do you tell yourself things down.
Hello. Wow. That was beautiful. What was that song, Nat?
That was called These Walls by Nessie Gomez. And she's not an Israeli. She's married to an Israeli, but she tours Israel a lot. And she sings these beautiful songs that touch the spirit and open the heart. We went to see her, and that song is very meaningful for me.
Thank you.
Hope you liked it.
I'm adding it to my list. Good. Of beautiful songs to listen to. Nat, so what I would love to hear is your thoughts on, just imagine that you're now teaching at a school in Australia. Okay? Just here.
You're starting to sweat.
And suddenly we've got this situation happening here where the kids, the teachers, all sorts of, you know, very, very pro-Gaza, pro-Hamas is probably the most, well, it is the most disturbing part of it all. And it's happening within the education system to the point that, you know, there are Jewish teachers in these schools who feel so uncomfortable if they don't agree with the narrative. What do you think the teachers need? What do the students need? What do we need to create peace somewhere? We're so far away from that conflict, and that's becoming a visible conflict within our society. Any thoughts?
I do have thoughts. It might not directly. I'm going to just give my own thoughts. I feel like I don't know that I would love to be a teacher in Australia, but not necessarily for the reasons that you said, but I think it relates. So what I love about Israeli society and my school is that there seems to be less focus on, it's got its own style of bureaucracy, but there's less focus on something very rigid here that I don't find in Israel around the education system. I feel like there's, you know, like something of my humanity got recovered at where I work. And it, I don't know that it's happening naturally as a result of this new, this freshness in that school and this incredible mission that it has to build a shared society, that it has to take responsibility for the humanity that's erupting or that's showing itself, that we rise and we grow and we evolve. And honestly, I feel like the seed is love. I really do. Like, I can't believe that I say that I love my fellow teachers. It's not an easy environment. Don't get me wrong. It's not easy. I think I cry most days or most weeks or every third week for different reasons, you know, but it feels like there is an evolution. And there's a listening heart that listens to the needs and goes with that. Australia, in my view, I grew up and I always felt like a minority, and I always felt like I was a Jew. And I feel like Australian society sits on top of unprocessed material that is now showing itself in a very ugly way. You know, like that. It's happening along in the world too, around sort of the shadow of its own unprocessed history. Its own crimes is now being vomited and projected onto Israel, Palestine. And it's me, it's so glaringly obvious. I'm like, well, hang on, why are you taking on this cause? Look at your own backyard.
Mm.
Face and focus on your own history of colonialism before you start you know, unbelievably projecting that onto another story that's not even your own. So I'm astounded when I see stories like that. And I'm even shaking. I'm even shaking thinking about it, because I would not want to be a teacher in that environment at all. I wouldn't want to be having to deal with it. I just remember the fear that I felt growing up. I mean, you know, in the 70s, in the 80s, in Australia, in Perth, and how there was just such a kind of Protestant majority of just like one narrative, and that was it. Like, it's my birthday in a couple of days, and I used to be asked, do you get your birthday presents at the same time as your Christmas presents or separately? And I'd go, separately or at the same time? Like, I didn't know how to say I'm Jewish, because there was... It wasn't overt. I wasn't getting hurt physically, but certainly there was such a lack of capacity to see the other. And so I just think it's such a mess here. It's such a mess. I read, you know, I got more traumatized reading, not more, but I got equally traumatized reading what goes on in Australia with the anti-Semitism and with the blindness and the ignorance than I do in Israel, you know, since after the first month of October 7th, when sort of life adjusted to a new norm, like we were functioning again. Of course, we were all traumatized. Everyone's traumatized there. There's no question about that. But I would also look at the news in Australia, and then my anxiety would go up, because I remembered what it was like and what's the mess that's happening now. And this is making me think even more so, this need to anchor ourselves in history and narratives and teach it and learn how to teach it. And systems are collapsing, but I feel hopeful that means that the rational, moderate, intelligent voices that are emerging need to step up and, you know, be the soldiers on the forefront of education and of rational, sound, educated opinion, dialogue.
How much do you think that the media and social media are playing a role in the minds of young people?
Oh, don't even. I mean, it's just...
That's a trick question.
Respect. Yeah, I just have no... I just don't even go there. I don't even go there. I don't even let myself think that that is a valid avenue of education anymore. It's just not.
It's not even education. It's not. It's now in.
Well, it can be.
No. But it is.
People,
it is,
wake up.
It is. It's the culture. It's more than education. Yeah. This is the culture that kids and adults are being brought up in.
And this is what I teach my students. Yeah, this is what I retrain them out of.
Okay.
I retrain them, you know. I do.
How?
I tell them the truth. I just say, don't believe. Don't put your mind. You have an opportunity to do something with your minds that is new, you know, and don't make your education social media. Don't, like, we, you know, I teach how to do research. How do you do research? What is that website? We go through all the, you know, ways of what it is to research, for example, and also
that's part of your role. Is that part of your role as a theatre teacher? Like, is that part of English
too.
In English? So you take on that.
Oh, of course,
literacy, because it's that the whole idea of media literacy, and it's so difficult though, because even if you go to the fact checkers, they themselves are controlled. It's everything has there's a higher level of how the narrative is being spun, and it's just, how do you do it? Like, there's just so much to know, to be able to know.
Well, one trick that will take you in a direction is simple: just follow the money, see who's funding whatever research you're reading, and then you need to see who's funding the research in the first place, the site that you're looking at, and then the research in the first place, and then the researchers, and see who's funding them. And that'll give you one story about whose narrative you're hearing.
But even that is difficult to access, Michael.
Yeah, these are all good suggestions and I'm going to take them on. I mean, what I teach is things like theatre traditions. So, you know, they're learning about British pantomime and Katakali. So I'm asking them to consult, you know, university sites. I mean, these are pretty benign topics. These aren't loaded topics that we're talking about there. But it's a training. It's a certain training. And the other thing that I do is invite them to confront that resistance when they hit a learning block. And they can't. It's like their brains struggle to work through these. It's you know, and where it's hard, where they just can't. Their brains can't. It's too hard, so they're going for the easy stuff, the Wikipedia or making it up in their own heads. And I really invite them to sit with the difficulty and say, this is a beautiful part of the learning process. It means that you're actually starting to understand something new when you hit that learning block. And they don't know these things. They think it should just arrive easily. Mm. So I invite them into working through that excruciating pain that comes when you don't understand something yet. And, I mean, I personally find it rewarding because I love learning, you know.
So you're taking them through unconscious incompetence to conscious incompetence to conscious competence to unconscious competence.
Ooh, I like that. That's your book.
That's the learning. That's the learning journey. And yes. They don't know what they don't know. And many people don't know. And this is what, for me, as a media person, a media educator, and that there is an unawareness of how much these narratives are now shaped through our media, social media, and the constructs around them, and how much in Australia it feels like that's the engine that's running the show, and the frustration of people within the Jewish community who are quite shocked that, you know, my ABC is no longer mine, it's someone else's. All these shocking revelations that are emerging, which happened during COVID as well, but now it's more obvious to different groups. Yeah, it's an interesting thing of how to teach media in a complex environment where there are so many vested interests in a much, much bigger way.
Yeah, and what comes to my mind is I just remember I wasn't always a learner, like in high school. I was sitting up the back and just being naughty. And it wasn't until actually that I, in my 20s, that I discovered Talmud Torah. And the whole our whole incredible history, thousands-year-old history of learning Torah, and how the Talmud learns itself out, and how concepts are learnt is such an incredible inheritance that we have. We have this literary intelligence that actually trains the brain in a certain way of thinking, and that's not a small thing in terms of mapping bigger issues. I think that's trained me very much to be able to see the other. I mean, I don't think that's the case with all Jews, but certainly I have gratitude towards my Jewish education that I took myself on myself. I didn't have formal Jewish education. I went on a journey. And I think that's an incredible asset, and I think that's something we can all draw from now as well.
Well, for Jews, Torah is the tool to connect to a higher level. And for everyone, it's a decision on whether they choose to want to use the tool or they just pay their mortgage, go to work,
right,
and struggle along.
And Michael's book is going to be called When Torah is in Exile.
Well, I'll tell you, Truth is in Exile is definitely the line of the day.
Yeah.
That is, because that feeds into the censorship issue, and without truth and transparency, we're going nowhere. So all the beautiful things that you've said today, that's the single biggest obstacle, is getting truth out. And the way things, especially on social media, I mean, the misinformation bill's coming up. This is no secret. You don't have to be Einstein to figure it out. It's out there. We're going to vote on it. And if it goes ahead, we're living in a different world and you'll never know it.
We have to wind up now. But on that, and I think we need to continue on that conversation, Michael. Natalie, thank you so much for sharing this. I know that this is very difficult to do at this time for you. And we would love to have you back or have you as a regular on our show, because I've always wanted you to be the journalist in Israel speaking with us. But let's talk more about it. Natalie Krasenstein is here from Israel, and she has just shared her very, very interesting story. Maybe we'll have you back here before you leave in the month to come, maybe?
Sure.
Maybe. And this is The Third Opinion Uncensored, and this is J-Air, 88.0 FM. And we have to go so that we can be ready for, I can see them waiting for the next show. Robert's looking at me. And so I'm going to say goodbye and thank you so much. Thank you for listening.
Thanks, Eva.
And The Third Opinion.
And Michael.
And the truth should come back.
Amen. The truth out of exile.
Yep.
To be continued.